Welcome to Guitar Radio Show, the show dedicated to the guitar player, guitar maker, gear builder, and purveyors of such items that you may not know about, but should.
Everybody talk. right, folks, welcome back to another episode of Guitar Radio Show. Our next guest's latest record, Deep Dark Demon, is an extra cool melting pot of American music. It weaves through blues, rock, Latin, and Creole flavors. It's a musical map that takes you through Memphis, New Orleans, Atlanta, all around the world without leaving the room, all by way of Houston, Texas. And that creator is here today to discuss all of that and more. Please welcome to Guitar Radio Show, Mr. Mark May. How are you, sir?
Doing great, Mark. How are you doing?
I'm all right. I'm okay. It's actually a beautiful day here in Austin, so I've been just absorbing your record and letting it roll over me. It's definitely one of those records that rolls over you. I just interviewed.
Thanks for kind words.
Yeah, man, it's great. I just heard the new Walter Trout record, and it's similar in nature as far as it's got all. It's within the realms of the blues genre. We are looking at expanding and bringing in other types of vibes and feel, and these records would be great bookend together. Matter of fact, I'd love to see you guys do a tour together. That would be cool.
Yeah, I love Walter. I've always loved him a lot, and we played a show together somewhere a long time ago, but I can't remember where. I grew up listening to so many different styles of music, and I like so much different stuff. But, you know, once I really got into the blues, those other styles kept coming out in me, but everything was just blues-based, you know.
Yeah.
Because, like I said, I listened to the Beatles and Hendrix, and you know, my brother turned me on to that stuff growing up, and my mom was a bluegrass-influenced country musician, because my uncle played in bluegrass bands in Kentucky and stuff, and so she sang all those old songs, the traditional ones, and, like people like George Jones and Tammy Wynette, and, you know, that country thing, and then my brother gave me the rock side of the influence and turned me on to the blues people. And then my aunt also, when I was young, I used to go to her house and stay for a weekend, and she had a B.B. King live at Cook County Jail, and she said, when you can play and sing like this, I'll come out and see you play, you know. And so I borrowed that record for a while and really got into that. So, but man, I've always liked all kinds of, Indian music and, Latin music and things like that, of course, I love Santana, and just all kinds of different stuff. So I like to try to put some of that stuff in my music without making it too weird, you know?
Well, it's not weird at all. Matter of fact, I mean, if you really think about it, you can kind of track back all of the song, all of the vibes, all the different styles of music that you're playing, and really all of the different styles of American music, with the exception of, say, classical music and maybe, old school country. Pretty much everything else really just, it's foundational in the blues, if you think about it. I mean, rock, certainly,
Right, yeah, like they say, the blues had a baby and they called it rock
and
roll.
That's exactly right, yeah. I mean, same with funk, same with R&B, I mean, all of it, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I just think that, I try to make everything, blues-based, but, kind of go into different styles. So it's, it's fun, it's interesting, you listen to some artists, and they basically have a style, and you can... And it's very recognizable, in the blues, somebody like a Fabulous Thunderbirds or something, they stick to their formula pretty much. I'm not saying that they don't expand on it here and there and doing everything, but it's not all over the map, like other artists. And it works both ways, I love their stuff too. I've always been a big fan of theirs, and, but my thing just happens to go in different directions, which I just kind of think it's fun and interesting to do that,
Yeah. Well, see, that's interesting that you brought up the T-Birds, because for me, the T-Birds, they're doing such a unique take on Chicago blues, adding that Texas shuffle to it. It makes it very unique, and they could do a shuffle all night long, you know, in C, sort of like how Billy Gibbons talks about that shuffle in C, you know, they could do that all night long and I could never get tired of it. But there, but the thing is there's certain blues musicians that when they do their thing, they do their thing so good, they don't have to, differ.
It's funny that you said that. I've used that exact same quote before, you know, and I said, you know, if you can play, you know, blues as good as somebody like the Thunderbirds or some, you know, these bands, like these top-notch bands, I can sit there and listen to it all night because they're just so good at it. Now, you know, if you're not quite as good, to some people it might get a little bit boring, but it just depends on what you like, you know. I mean, everything's just a matter of personal taste and everything, but yeah, there's nothing better than a, you know, great blues band. I can sit there listen to Shuffles all night if they're a good band.
Absolutely. I mean, like the Moeller Brothers and Anson Funderburg, the Red Devils, you know, all that stuff.
Anson was a big influence on me early on when I first started playing blues. I know I don't sound like it much, but if you listen to some of my older records, like my first one and stuff, like the first song, "You're Little Baby," you can kind of probably, you know, between Anson and Albert Collins, I was kind of relying heavily on to kind of get Texas sound going, you know, because I'm not from here originally, but when I got down here, I got into, you know, Albert Collins, and you know, I was already into Stevie Ray and ZZ Top and those kind of bands.
Sure. You know. Where are you from originally?
Columbus, Ohio area.
Oh, wow. Okay, cool. A lot of rock and roll there.
Yeah, it's actually a great little town, man. I went back there and lived for a few years to spend some time with my dad back in 2010 or 11. There's a lot of great musicians there, and we had fun playing there. You know, I got a lot of friends and family in the area, and I had a good time, and I decided to come back to Texas and you know, the blues scene down here has always been great for me. And Houston has always had a lot of places to play and everything here. Mm-hmm. And I kind of like to move around, kind of, you know, like a gypsy and musician, I guess.
Yeah, you know, yeah, for sure.
I'll live someplace for a couple of years and never know when I might, you know, move someplace else for a couple of years.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, and that also influences the playing. It influences the intention, influences it all.
Oh, it does, because you get around different styles, and I'm sure if I was to move over to New Orleans or somewhere, I'd be trying to pick up on a lot of stuff that they do over in that area, which is, like you said, a lot more Creole-based blues, you know, and, you know, that sort of thing, you know, which is always good stuff, you know.
Yeah, like Brian Lee and people like that, you know, for sure.
Yeah, Tab and Juan, all these people that
Tab,
play, you
right.
know.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, stuff that's right from the swamp, you know.
Yeah, right on. So yeah, it's you know, like you living in Houston, you know, post Katrina, Houston had an influx of folks from New Orleans and Biloxi and
we had a lot of people that moved over here. Thousands.
Yeah, I got a bunch of friends actually who are living in Houston now that were originally from, you know, some of them were in the Ninth Ward, and they brought that influence in every way, shape, and form, musical, food, everything, to Houston. And that's become quite a melting pot as well. I mean, it always was.
Yeah.
But
yeah, there was always some of that influence over here because it's only, you know, 6 hours from here. And, you know, people go back and forth some. But, you're definitely right about the fact that when Katrina happened, we had a big influx of, you know, a lot of people, a lot of musicians, you know, that came. Some of them stayed, you know, some of them, you know, went back once things, you know, got bearable over there, you know.
Yeah.
So, but it's always cool to have those other influences come into your neighborhood. That way you can kind of soak it up that way a little bit.
Oh,
too,
yeah, absolutely. Know? That osmosis is wonderful. So when you set out to record this record, were a lot of these songs already pre-written, and you had an idea of what you wanted to do? Or?
I had most of the basic parts of the songs written. Mm-hmm. You know, I would get over to record, you know, because I recorded it at a place called Western Recorders, which is over on the west side of Houston. A friend of mine, Geronimo, Calderon has a studio at his house, but it's real nice. He's got real good equipment and stuff. And so we kind of took our time, you know, but sometimes I'd be doing a song and say, oh yeah, I got to go home and write the last verse to this. You know, but I had pretty much, you know, everything in my head as far as the arrangements and things like that. I didn't have all the solos worked out, because some of them were just improvised and some of them were just, you know, I wrote out here at the house, the ones that are more like signature kind of solos, you know, right. Or the twin lead parts that were, yeah. You know, I had to work out the harmonies and stuff. I didn't want to spend too much time over there. Just, hey, hang on, let me work on this, you know, wanted to be productive while I was there. So,
yeah. How long did it take to record this?
A long time, actually. It took over a year because Geronimo is also a drummer who plays with me and lots of other bands around town, and he has a job. And so, you know, I play pretty often down here, you know, and several times a week, and then give a few guitar lessons. And so between the two of us, just getting the schedule straightened out, you know, I pretty much built the album in the studio, so it wasn't like we just went in and laid it down live, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, just so it was kind of just a building process, you know. But so it took a while, and I re-recorded a few things, and you know, so it took longer than I wanted it to, but I'm really glad about the results, because you know, I'm happy with the songs and the way it sounds and everything. And,
no, it's and, a great. It's really just it's such a great collection of songs that work well together, which is, that's not always easy to create an ebb and flow of, you know, sequencing makes an album.
Yeah. It's always hard to decide, you know, what to put where, you know, I mean, you want to put songs that you think people will like, especially DJs or, you know, interviewers, guys like you. Mm-hmm. You want to try to put those songs early on. Mm-hmm. You know, you'd like to build the album if you can, but at the same time, if you don't put some of your best songs, you know, fairly early on, you might lose them before they get to the best songs. So it's tough to do it that way, you know. Mm-hmm. And my albums are always pretty long, you know, they're always, the songs are probably longer than they should be for radio airplay, but still, that's just kind of my world, you know. I just I try to keep the real commercial ones like Barbecue and Blues fairly short, because I know that some guys don't, you know, like to play songs that are over 4 or 5 minutes long most of the time.
Yeah, so, I'm just the opposite.
Yeah, blues. Well, blues guys also don't have long radio shows, you know, so they have 2 or 3 hours maybe, right, to put in what they like. So right, they don't want to take 10 minutes on one song. You know,
I'm just the opposite. I want to do the long songs. I want to hear the long ones.
I love long songs, you know. I mean, there's I don't know if the general public is much like me and you.
Yeah, yeah. I guess we're the minority here.
Yeah.
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 So on the way in, we heard one of my favorite tracks off the record, a track called Back, and okay. That mm-hmm. sounds pretty autobiographical.
Yeah, you know, I think if you're an independent musician, unless you have a, you know, huge amount of success, you're always kind of looking back at you know, wow, at that time point in my career, I really had a lot going on. You know, I had this record deal. I was playing with these guys. We were on tour with these guys. And it's also, you know, about looking back at, you know, being younger and, you know, and having a relationship with somebody that, you know, that maybe you wish you still had and things. It's kind of about different things, you know.
Yeah.
It's not really just about one subject, you know. But yeah, there's a couple of songs on this album about getting older, you know, but I guess it's just part of life, you know. You
yeah,
just start looking back a little bit and seeing what you did good and
yeah,
what you did bad, and hopefully learning from it, you know. Yeah. Or, you know, maybe you want to go back and just say, you know, apologize to somebody for something, I don't know, you know, just looking back at what you've done, you know, and trying to improve on it still, because, you know, I'm still working on this thing, you know.
Yeah, well, I think that's great that you're ruminating enough to be reflective of where you've been and where you're going, and, you know, people can get a lot from that. They can definitely feel the same way of what you're saying, and also maybe learn something from it too.
Yeah, I think that's the main thing, is just try to learn from stuff that maybe you didn't get quite right, or mm-hmm. or even learn the fact that, and, you know, I was doing that before and, you know, doing something this way and it was working really good. Maybe I should slide back over that way and try mm-hmm. to do, you know, something similar to it. And, you know, you're always trying, in the music business especially, you're always trying to figure out what the right thing to do is, and because there's no manual. You can't go to school for 8 years and be guaranteed a mm-hmm. successful career, you know.
Yeah, that's true. So this particular track has a real cool Latin vibe to it. I really want to see this song perform live.
So do I.
tell me a little bit. I mean, I know that you play a lot of Les Pauls, which you must have a very strong back, because they're heavy.
I don't play a lot of Les Pauls. I do have one now that I just got a while back that I've been playing some, and I like it a lot. And it kind of goes back and forth, but mainly I play this Robin Savoy, which is kind of like a 335.
Wow, Robin, holy cow.
I do really like the Les Paul I got, you know. I've been playing and having fun with it just for something different. But for years I've played a Robin Savoy. It's gold top with white binding. And it's really a nice sounding guitar too. But I kind of go back and forth between those two a lot right now.
Right. So walk us through the rig on that, on this particular track. What were you using here?
On that track I was using my Robin Savoy, and I'm not sure exactly what. Usually for my on my pedal board, I'll use, it's kind of weird, I use a Sparkle Drive mm-hmm. for almost for like a clean boost. I have the gain down on it,
right,
and use a regular tube screamer, you know, some kind of reissue tube screamer that I use for more of the overdrive. So I was using probably those two, I believe, on that with my Savoy, and most of the time we were using my Naylor amp, mm-hmm. but we would take several different amps. I had a Boogie, the Naylor, I can't remember, there's a Plexi amp that the guy had the studio reissue of some sort. It wasn't a Marshall, but it's supposed to be that we use quite a bit. And it was one of those three. I know I used the Naylor for sure. And, I just used that basically on that song, trying to get a, you know, kind of a Carlos Santana tone, you know?
Yeah. So that's interesting that you're using the Sparkle Drive as basically like a always on, like an always on pedal.
Yeah, it's bizarre. There's a friend of mine here in town, Greg Walton, and he has Exact Tone pedals in Nashville, and they build racks and pedals and stuff like that. I don't know if you've seen any of their pedals or not.
Mm-hmm.
He used to help me with my pedal board all the time years ago, and he kind of set it up for me that way, and, you know, it sounded really good. And gosh, it was so long ago, you know. I mean, there's so many cool boost pedals that you use now.
Oh, God, yeah.
That people love a lot. But I just use that as a boost, strangely enough, with the gain down. But it's kind of cool because it's got a tone control and a clean button. You know, kind of brings in more of the clean amp, and then a volume on it, which is pretty easy to get to if you're doing something and you can't quite hear yourself. You can kind of boost that up with your foot a little bit, you know, mm-hmm. in the middle of a song or something. So just kind of got started using that, you know, and it just really sounded good with the other stuff that I was using. So I've just kind of continued to use it, and it's worked good for me for a number of years. Now, I'm sure that sooner rather than later, I'm sure one of those pedals will probably die on me, because I've been using it for a long time, and I'll have to. But I've been experimenting with some other stuff anyway. You know, I have a Tumnus on there, and I have one of the Exactone Atomic Overdrive on there, and I use all those on the album, right, also, you know, on different songs.
Do you ever get paranoid about that type of thing where, oh man, I've been using this such a long time, it's gonna crap out on me, and
I gotta
go see if I can find another one?
yeah, you must be reading my mind, you know. I do that stuff all the time. I always try to, if I like something that much, I usually try to have a spare around somewhere. Yeah. Sometimes I just put it under the seat in my car or something.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, I can't get through a gig without one, you know?
<It's like laughs> That's how I feel that way about the Nobles OD. I just love that thing, man. It's changed everything for me. Guthrie Trapp from Nashville turned me onto it. And,
it's the Nobles OD?
Yeah, Nobles ODR1.
Yeah, I've heard of those. I don't think I've ever played them.
Oh my God. I fell in love with it so much, I immediately ran out and bought two more.
Yeah, because, you know, you're afraid they'll stop making.
Yeah, something happens. What am I going to do?
Change them, yeah. You know, and I used to have two of everything, you know, at one point, you know. But, you know, you got to be able to afford it too.
Exactly. That's the truth. That's funny.
Which isn't too bad with pedals, but when you start talking about amplifiers and guitars and all that stuff, then yeah, it gets expensive.
But, you know, it's funny. I get kind of weird about amplifiers. For me, it's, you know, now I've been playing, I was playing boogies for years and years, and then I said, you know what, these things are just too damn heavy to be dragging around. They're just so heavy. So I had never even played through a Vox ever in my life. And somebody said, just go try one. So I went and I tried one out, and I tried out an AC30, and I was like, it's good. It's a little too powerful for what I need. I tried out the AC15, and I, you know, cranked it, and I was like, wow, this is amazing. And now I'm like, okay, since I can get these, like, no problem, you know, I don't worry about amps so much anymore. As long as I have that Nobles, I'm okay.
Yeah, right. I mean, and you kind of got to be like that anyway. I mean, if you do any kind of fly into gigs or anything, you have to rely on some of those.
Yeah.
Unless you're a plug straight in guy, you have to rely on bringing a couple pedals, you know, and just kind of getting your tone, you know, partially with those if you like to use overdrive like I do.
Yeah. Have you ever had a nightmare fly gig like that?
You know, nothing too bad. Every once in a while, you know, you've had, you know, like an amp that just doesn't sound very good.
Yeah.
I played a couple times in New York the past few years with some guys I used to be in Dickie Betts' band with.
Uh-huh.
And a place called The Cutting Room. And they, you know, they just had backline amplifiers. And the first time we played it, we got there and they had a deluxe and like two different deluxes and like a supersonic. And so I grabbed the supersonic because I knew that the other guys probably just would want regular Fenders. Plus the supersonic has a little overdrive on it. And, mm-hmm. you know, I figured that along with whatever pedals I brought, I could kind of get my tone because, you know, the Nailer, he has a nice overdrive and I leave it on a little bit, you know. And, but it cleans up nicely when I turn my guitar volume down.
Right.
Nice thing. But the second time we went up there to play the same gig, we were just getting together and doing a bunch of all my brother's songs. Because everybody there had either played with Dickie or Greg or somebody, you know, it was one of those sort of things. And but like two of the amps weren't working. And it was just kind of a nightmare. We were like, you know, trading amps back and forth in the middle of the gig. You know, hey, you want to try this one? I'll try that one. And mm-hmm. nobody could really get a good tone, but
right.
We still had fun. But yeah, every once in a while you run into one that just doesn't sound good. And I'm terrible at that. I get really used to using the same equipment And I see guys that go from just one setup to another, to one guitar to another, that seem like it doesn't bother them one bit. And with me, it bothers me more than it should.
I can dig it. Yeah. But, you know, it's like even the strings don't feel right under your fingers, you know.
Yeah, it throws everything off.
It does.
You know, for me.
And, absolutely.
Like I said, it makes me mad to see somebody who can just jump on anything and sound exactly like themselves and look like it's effortless. And you're like, damn, man, I wish I could do that. You know?
I did one thing in New York where I had several dates over the course of a few days. And every place we landed, there was a different rig. Mm-hmm. So it was like starting from ground zero every day. It was a nightmare.
Yeah.
It was a nightmare.
Yeah, it's got to be tough. I always feel for, like, you know, drummers and bass players, because right. when you do a lot of festivals, they just always have to play whatever rig or whatever drum kit's up there.
Yeah.
And they seem to get used to it, though. And I think really that's what it is just once you start doing that stuff enough, then you'll get used to it. But, you know, luckily or unluckily, either way you want to look at it, for guitar players, you can, if you have your amp with you, you can just throw it up there and plug it in and you're ready to go. It doesn't take long to set up like a drum kit.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, it's not big to move like a bass rig. But, you know, they seem to get used to it. But I feel sorry for them sometimes, because you can tell, you know, when you get off stage, man, it'll be like, that drum kit is terrible. You know, that kit sucked or whatever. So, but we've all been there, you know.
Oh, yeah, for sure. So let's talk about another couple of tracks, because I'm jumping around the record because I really love this.
Okay, sure. Yeah.
So Rolling Me Down, it's got this French Quarter kind of stomp going on. Where'd that originate from for you?
Well, you know, I've always liked that kind of music, the New Orleans style music, you know, jazzy blues, you know, swampy kind of feel, you know, that's, mm-hmm. it's good stuff. And like you said, we have quite a few musicians over here that play stuff like that have either migrated here or were born somewhere between Houston and New Orleans, you know, because, you know, it's only a couple hours into Louisiana from here. So it doesn't take long to get that that influence going on. So, you know, even early on when I first came down here and played in country bands, when I first moved here in the 80s, you know, we're doing songs like Matilda and all these kind of standard, you know, songs that were Louisiana-based songs. I, at the time, I had no idea where they came from or anything about them, but I slowly learned, oh, this song's, you know, from this band, and, you know, so you kind of start getting the influence and stuff. Plus, you know, my girlfriend's from Donaldsonville, Louisiana, which is just south of Baton Rouge,
mm-hmm.
and so we go over there pretty often, you know, and just from being down here, if you're down here in Texas anywhere, I think you're going to get some of that Louisiana kind of style influence,
mm-hmm.
because, you know, people go back and forth a lot to play gigs, and so it's that's just kind of part of living down here, I think, is getting some of the Latin influence and some of the Cajun blues influence and
yeah.
stuff like that.
Yeah,
I think,
for sure, know? For sure. So, you know, it's so funny. Since I got the record, I've been really, like I said, I've been listening to it an awful lot. And I keep deciding, oh, this is my favorite tune. Oh, this is my favorite tune. And today I decided that For Your Love was my favorite song today.
Oh, wow.
I don't know how that's going to be tomorrow. But that cool R&B vibe.
Yeah, you know, when I first recorded that song and wrote it, I thought, well, that's a you know, pretty much an R&B soul song. And it's not, now I did have a song like that on my Telephone Road record called Took Me By Surprise that we had the Memphis Horns play on it. And it was pretty much just a soul song with a little bit of Robin Trower's kind of guitar in it, you know?
Right.
And cause that stuff always, that kind of bluesy guitar playing fits in that music. Now, a lot of times you don't hear it that much in soul music, you know, it was more about just making the track work. It wasn't really guitar heavy music. But yeah, you know, I mean, I love soul and R&B and all that stuff. You know, all my, a lot of my favorite singers, you know, Gladys Knight and all these people, I grew up listening to. I just love listening to, you know, to those singers. And so I just kind of sat down and wrote this song, you know, and like I said, I recorded it in, you know, I had one interviewer that I, you know, saw somebody who wrote a review of my album. And he said, at first he wasn't sure that that song fit on the album, but he said after he listened to it a couple of times, he was cool with it, you know, and he liked the song.
Mm-hmm.
But it is different, you know. But yeah, I just, like I said, I just record stuff that I like, and I don't worry too much about it being way far. As long as it's got a bluesy feel to it, I'm okay with it. But yeah, it's definitely an R&B and soul song. It's kind of catchy, I guess, you know?
Oh yeah, man, I just love it. It's
and then one day I thought maybe I stole it, you know, so I got up and thought to myself, and the first thing you do nowadays when you think you stole something is like put the name of the song on, you know, in YouTube or something or Google, you know. And so, you know, So I look it up, and there's a Stevie Wonder song on there called For Your Love, you know, and he kind of says For Your Love a couple times like I do, and I'm thinking, did I hear that when I was a kid and kind of stuck with me? I mean, the two songs aren't really very much alike,
right,
besides just that line, you know. But when I listen to it, I'm like, okay, well, that's far enough apart that I didn't steal it, you know.
Right.
And I remembered that song after I heard it, but I hadn't thought about it in years or anything. But they're so much different that I don't feel like I ripped it off. But
oh yeah, well, for sure. I mean, the Yardbirds had a song called For Your Love, but it sounds nothing
right.
like that.
Yeah, sure. It's definitely not close to that one.
Not at
it
all.
It definitely doesn't sound like that.
Not
at all. Yeah.
That's great. So then there's sort of a left turn on the record with a track called My Last Ride, which has got that Southern rock vibe and those dual guitars.
Mm-hmm.
So when you play live, do you have another guitar player with you or no?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
I've had two guitar players for years, you know. Even before I did my stint with the Dickie Betts band, I was using two guitar players. Started out with a harmonica player on my first record, and we were a little bit more like a traditional Texas blues kind of band, like we talked about Thunderbirds,
yeah.
You know, Anson Thunderbird. We were kind of a little bit more of that kind of band, but we still did some blues rock stuff. But then when the harmonica player left the band, I got another guitarist, and he started doing, he was a real talented guy, and he started doing a little bit of harmony on some of the signature parts that I did. And I really liked it and thought, you know, I'd always liked Southern rock and harmony, twin leads and things like that. Big influence for me was Rick Derringer's albums in the 70s, the Blue Derringer album and the Sweet Evil album. And that was one of my first concerts, actually, when I was 14.
Mm-hmm.
I went to a concert hall and saw Max Webster and Rick Derringer and Rush when 2112 was just coming out.
Oh, my goodness.
And Derringer and his other guitar player, you know, they were doing a bunch of twin stuff and playing off each other and doing all that. And I really thought it was cool.
Yeah.
And I went out and bought their albums. And then, you know, I had a friend who turned me on the Allman Brothers. So I always liked that stuff, but I'd never really done any of it in blues until this guy came along. And he didn't do a lot of it, but he did enough of it that I just thought, well, I kind of like that. You know, nobody's really using the twin thing too much in the blues world. So maybe that can make that part of my signature thing. And then a little later on, some friends of mine introduced me to Dickie Betts, and I ended up playing in his band after he was out of the Allman Brothers. So in 2000 and 2001, I played with him. And of course, he does tons of that kind of stuff.
Right.
So, you know, and so it didn't, you know, definitely influenced that song, just, you know, being around. We'd already toured. Once I met him, we toured with the Allman Brothers in 1997, and then later on I ended up in Dickie's band. So, so yeah, it was, you know, that's definitely had a big influence on my plan, is just being around, you know, those guys. And, you know, I, like I said, I grew up listening to that music. I remember going to one of my first big concerts up in Ohio, and Dickie was playing, you know, back in like 77 or something like that. You right. know, and I was still in high school, you know?
Yeah. And, I had Jack Pearson on the show, and he was saying, part of the reason he has lost as much hearing as he has was because he was playing beside Dickie Betts.
Yeah. Yeah, I heard it was tough. Well, you know, yeah, back then, Dickie played through 200-watt Marshalls,
right.
I believe.
Exactly.
And two 412 cabinets with JBLs in them, so, which made him a little clearer, you
right.
know. And so one day when we were on tour with them in 97, they were working on one of his amps, and they didn't really do sound check. Their crew would just basically set the stuff up like they liked it, and they were always kind of relaxed. They would come out and plug in their stuff and, you know, talk a little bit and tune up and stand on stage for a few minutes before they started. You know, they didn't just have this big, you know, the Allman Brothers band, and the first note would you know, they get right started at a song, they come out and just casually kind of get their gear like they liked it, you know, because they didn't do sound check. And but one day they were working on his amp, and we had to do sound check. I think we were the guinea pigs for the sound check. So they asked me, they said, "Hey, Mark, come over here and play Dickie's guitar through his amp. We were working on it, make sure it's okay." So I go over there and I put on his old guitar, you know, his old gold top. I'm like, cool, man, you know, that's the first time I think I'd played it. And so I turned it, you know, up about halfway, and I was just playing it, you know, and then they go like, "No, turn it up all the way." I turned it up all the way and hit a few notes, and I was like, turned around, I said, "That's how loud he plays?" They're like, "Yeah." I go, "Oh my God," you know, and it was really loud, you know. I mean, they have a big band too, you know, but yeah. Still, it was really, because I was using the Super, you know, back then.
So right, which is no slouch. Compared. Which is no slouch.
No, you know, it was loud too, but when I played with him, he'd cut it down to 250-watt reissue heads.
Okay. And, how nice of him.
So, yeah. Well, we were playing smaller places, of course. We weren't playing amphitheaters every
right,
night.
Right.
You know, playing a lot of small clubs. But those Marshalls are loud, man. I mean,
yeah.
At the time, I was using he had bought me a.
Well, those were non-master Marshalls.
Yeah, right. He had old ones. You
yeah.
know? And he had bought me a Fender Tone Master. And one day he just called me into his hotel room. We're out on tour. He said, "I don't know if I think your tone's as good as it was last year." And I told him, I said, "You know what? I don't think my tone's as good as it was last year either." I said, "I'm using the same gear." And he said, "Well, why don't you go out and buy one of these Fender Tone Masters? My son uses one and it sounds really good." And he gave me his credit card, and I went off to whatever music store in Rochester, New York it was, the House of Guitars or something.
Yeah, House of Guitars, yeah.
This Tone Master in two cabinets. And so I was using that in a 5150, you know, head with a, you know, 412 cabinet. So even my 200-watt amps didn't seem like – it seemed like I ran them on four, and he was running his 50-watt Marshalls on three. You know, and you know, we were both the same volume, so you know, those Marshalls are loud, man.
Yeah, they are loud. They are loud.
But yeah, Jack is one of my favorite players.
Oh yeah, I mean, probably one of the best on the planet. If you really get right down to it.
Yeah, well, I have a funny story about that too. You know, I mean, in 1997 when I met Dickie. He came over to Sarasota, this little club called the 5 o'clock club, with these two friends of mine who knew him. We'd been going over there and playing. And these two guys come out to this club, and they liked us a lot. And the guy told me, he said, "Yeah, man, I golf with Dickie Betts. Me and my dad own this golf shop, and he shops there. And I'll give him your CD." And, you know, of course, I'm thinking, yeah, I'm sure he gets them every day, you know. And So eventually the guy, you know, kept bugging him about it. And Dickie told me, he said, you know, Jimmy just kept asking me to listen to your stuff. And he said, I finally just got tired of him asking me. And I just, you know, threw it in my CD player. And he's like, I really liked it. You know, I thought you kind of played cool Albert Collins licks and your voice was a little bit like Freddie King's. And, you know, so he wanted to come see us. And so Jimmy called me and said, hey, he wants to come see you guys. I said, really? So that can't be possible, you know? And so he came out to this club and he liked us and said, you know, I want you guys to come on tour with us places where we don't sell out or we don't need like a big opener, somebody can bring, you know, several hundred people or more, you know, but places that we automatically just sell out. He said, I want to see if we can bring you guys on board, get you some exposure. I'm like, great, that'd be awesome, you know? So about 2 weeks later, we're still in Florida playing, we're in Port Charlotte. I get a page from this guy, Jimmy, and I called him and he says, yeah, Dickie wants to talk to you. And so I just assumed that, you know, it was about this tour. And I called him up and he said, hey, man, he goes, I'm not trying to break your band up or anything, but would you and your bass player like to come try out for the Allman Brothers? And I'm just like, what'd you just say? You know? And, you know, I just thought I heard wrong or something because, you know, you don't just get asked. We just met him, you know, like 2 weeks ago. And right. All of a sudden he's asking me to come try out. And I'm like, well, yeah, you know, I mean, who wouldn't, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, Alan and Warren were doing the Government Mule thing and they were, you know, had some kind of disagreement about something. But anyway, a few months later, and I told him, I said, I don't really play slide that well. I knew it was a slide player's job. He said, well, you know, if you can play a little bit, that's fine. He goes, I played after Dwayne died. And so between the two of us, we'd be okay. And I said, I didn't feel very confident about it, you know. But still, at the same time, I couldn't turn down the opportunity just to even go spend a few days with him or whatever, right?
Yeah.
So I thought maybe they had gotten things worked out, you know, and I went home and started working on my slide playing a little bit, trying to get ready. And then he finally called and said, do you want to come out next weekend? And I said, sure. And I'd worked up Statesboro Blues pretty well and worked on a few other songs. But like I said, I never really played that much slide. So, but went out and tried out. It was me, Dickie, and this bass player, David Stoltz. And no drummers, no Greg, nobody else. And Jack Pearson had also tried out. And, of course, he got the job.
Mm-hmm.
And then me and David, that bass player, ended up playing with Dickie later. So it still worked out for me. But still, when we went on that tour and I saw Jack Pearson play and looked at him, I was like, oh, okay. I said, yeah, I'm sure it took them at least 15 seconds to decide between me and him because he was just so incredible, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's the crazy thing about Jack, too, is, like, you know, he can play almost any stringed instrument under the sun. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah, he can play all kinds of stuff, you know, and he's just really flawless on everything.
Yeah.
You know, he's one of these guys who never plays sloppy or anything.
Yeah.
And, it's encouraging and discouraging at the same time.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Absolutely.
Makes you want to practice or quit.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I feel that way a lot. So, I feel that way a lot.
It's not hard to, you know, and then you just got to tell yourself, okay, you know, I'm this, you know,
yeah.
I'm a good package. I sing pretty good.
Right.
I play pretty good. I write pretty good songs.
That's how it's got to be.
Yeah. Am I going to be in the front of Guitar Player magazine or Guitar World? Probably not, but, you know, but still, people like what I do.
It's about knowing your lane. You know, what lane am I in here?
Okay. Exactly, you know, and just you know, if people, you know what, and if people like you, that's good music. It doesn't have to be.
Well, that's exactly, you know, right, and that's why I wanted. That's why I wanted to talk to you, because, you know, when I heard the record, you know, and Doug sent me the record, I was like, I'm like, okay, let's see what this is all about. You know, I pop this on and I listen to it, and I'm like, holy crap, this is great. And because it's got a spirit, you know what I mean? And that's something that you look for too. I, at least for me as a listener, I listen to so much music day in, day out, from the moment I wake up till right before I shut my eyes. And sometimes I'm listening to stuff in bed with earbuds on, you know, and, you know, because there's always something to be listening to and checking it out so I can bring it to the people. And, you know, it's not just about, you know, obviously it's about good songwriting, good singing, good playing and all that stuff, but it's also about spirit, you know, and there's an intention. And when somebody has an intention in their music, it's impossible not to recognize it or for it to perk up your ears. And that's how I feel about Deep Dark Demon.
Thanks, man.
You know, it's definitely has a strong intention. So you nailed it.
Well, I love playing, and that's all I've done for a long time for a living. And, I love being in the studio, recording and creating new albums. I don't do it quite often enough. I need to try to keep more music coming out so more consistently, you know, because it seems like it always takes me 4 or 5 years to get a record out. But this next CD that we're supposed to do, if things go good with this album, with Mike Zito, he'll probably produce it in his studio. And I'm sure it'll be out a lot quicker because his style of recording an album is a lot quicker than
He works fast.
He works fast. I'll just have to be more prepared and everything. You know, yep. It's a little scary, but still, at the same time, it'll be interesting to do stuff a little bit different way and have somebody else who I admire, their input on things. And, it'll be fun, you know.
Yeah, it's a good challenge.
More prepared.
It's a great challenge for you. I think that's great. You got to always push yourself. You always got to challenge yourself.
Because usually I just kind of produce my own stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of just put the music together and have my engineer try to guide me a little bit, so it'll be different this time, but I think it'll be a good thing for me because I've never really done much stuff like that where, mm-hmm. Somebody was trying to help me in the studio. So, mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. I love Mike's stuff. It's he has some great songs and a good idea. So I think it'll be a lot of fun.
He's another intense player too. I mean, very, in your face. He's an in your face player. I like that.
Yeah, we played with him the other night at a place called Do-Si-Do here in town. And it had been a while since I'd seen one of his whole shows. And it was a real nice – he builds his shows real nice as far as starting out with not mellow stuff necessarily, but just kind of building it into the more rocking stuff as the show goes along. I thought it was real nice the way he built the show, his songs – a lot of his songs tell a good story. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, man, I can't thank you enough for taking some time out to talk to me and my audience. The record's great, and I wish you nothing but success with it.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. I enjoyed it. I always love talking about guitars and effects and, music and stuff. I'm really glad to be hooked up with these guys at Gulf Coast Records. They have a good label going, and I'm hoping it's going to help me get, get my career going a little better. Mm-hmm. And I'm just happy to be, still making music and feeling good about it. And like you said, I just got a kind of a nice spirit about it right now. I'm just happy about still going out and making my own music and, being able to make a living at it somewhat, maybe not so much at this point, but... Yeah. It's been a little tough with the COVID thing.
Sure.
But in other ways, it's been good because I've been working on, merchandising and, different things that, I did one live streaming show and it went real well, but it's just not my thing to play by myself. I just did it by myself and I've always played with the band. Sure. So all these new things that we're all trying, as uncomfortable as they might be, I think that it's good for all of us to try to, you know, because obviously we all know that music and everything else is kind of headed that way anyway. There may be some people that never play another live gig after this. They may just always do streaming.
You never know.
It's going to be involved in music somehow, you know, from here on out, because there's several clubs where people are playing at, and even if they have a good crowd and everything else, they're still going to stream that thing. And maybe pick up some extra money from tips and different things. So it's definitely changed the scene, a little bit, this whole thing. So
I think
it's going to be interesting to see how it goes.
I think we're looking at a new landscape of music and music promotion. For sure. Yeah. When all this craziness is over, I hope we get to see you here in Austin. That would be cool.
Yeah, I've been wanting to get up there and play, and we were just getting ready to try to book a few things and get out and promote these songs. And of course, the situation we have now is kind of making it so we can't do that. But you guys have a lot of great venues up there if they can stay open, through this whole thing.
Yeah, I'm hoping.
We've lost a few here. Have you guys lost any there?
We lost a couple of things. As far as clubs, nothing hugely significant. But anytime you lose a venue, it's always a heartbreaker. We lost a place that's been around since the late 60s, a place called Shady Grove,
I think I might have saw something about that.
Yeah, that was a heartbreaker. And Threadgills.
I saw that too.
So that's a heartbreak. Those are heartbreakers. Even from a food standpoint, because their food was great. So, that's a bummer. And there's a part of me that's holding on to hope that, when all this is over and done with, and we're trying to get back to some sort of whatever normal's going to be, that those folks find somebody to invest in them to come back and try it again.
Yeah, there's been several clubs that have done that here, and there, a couple of them have said, we're going to reopen and do something a little different, and maybe find a different location. But maybe it wasn't working so good for them in the first place. Yeah. And this is just the perfect time for them to make the change.
Yeah.
Hopefully some good things will come out of this. Obviously, it's not the way we wanted things to happen with people, being sick or even passing away from it. So it's unfortunate that any of it has to do with that. But it definitely, like you said, has changed the landscape on how people look at music and how they're going to perform and how they're going to, promote their stuff.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. So, folks, the album is called Deep Dark Demon. It's from the Mark May Band. It is so good. I say this all the time, and I mean it. Don't just stream it. Go and buy it, because this way, if you buy it, he can make more of it. If you like it, he'll make more of it. So you just streaming ain't going to pay the bills. So go and buy it. Where can folks pick it up?
That's what I was going to say. You can get it at my website, markmay.com.
Great.
Or you can go on one of my Facebook pages. And there's links to it for if you want to download it or buy a physical CD. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty easy to find right now. They can get it there.
All right. Well, cool. We're gonna listen to another track on the way out. And once again, man, thanks for being on the show. I appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for asking me, and I hope we can meet up sometime soon.
That would be great.
We're close together, and I have a nephew that lives up there by the lake, and I need to get up there and see him anyway.
So. Okay, great. Yeah, maybe we can go do some guitar shopping.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks so much, sir. Hold on one second, but we're going to sign off right here. We'll be right back.
Check out Guitar Radio Show on iTunes, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Stitcher Radio, GuitarRadioShow.com, and anywhere you get your podcasts. Find Guitar Radio Show on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And remember, if you like the artists you hear on Guitar Radio Show, don't just stream their music, buy it.
GRS Productions.